himself more than any other evangelist in America. And Finney proceeded to develop a theology and a practice that would have influence also in the wider church culture, so-called new measures, which were adopted in some degree by the American Lutherans, Benjamin Kurtz, Samuel Simon Schmucker, all products of this kind of general era. Hollifield comments that sometime after the Civil War, the pastoral theologians lost their sense of balance. By the end of the century, they would have little to say about the ideal of balance among the faculties or the notion of pastoral conversation, or a balanced appeal to sentiment, reason, and volition. They spoke more often about the vitality of human nature, either the force of the will or the dynamism of the subconscious impulse. They talked about the power and energy, effort and mastery, force of character, and boldness of decision, and of the natural processes of human life. And by 1895, Washington Gladden could announce that the revolution or the revision was now complete. He says, here I quote Gladden, "Christianity is no longer anti-natural, it is in the deepest sense natural." What does this do then to an understanding of pastoral care? That pastoral care is primarily given to what? To simply the natural functions of human life. That the Enlightenment has simply eroded away any kind of understanding of the miraculous or the sacramental. And so pastoral care, if it is to be effective and efficient in this new era, has to attend to what Gladden calls the deepest natural impulses that are there. And so we see a shift in pastoral theology away from any kind of orientation toward God, toward Christ, toward the scriptures, the sacraments, the church, and instead toward the person. So Henry Church King in 1901 could comment, the first and foremost, the constant, the last and the greatest study of the theologian must be of persons and personal relationships. And you will see this language in the 20th century become full blown. Yeah. Person-centered counseling, for example. Non-directive counseling, the kind of the approaches to counseling that inform so many of the pastoral counseling textbooks of the 50s, the 60s, and dare I say even in to the current time. Stuart Hiltner, Howard Kleinbell, names that no doubt might ring a bell because I think they were used at our seminaries in the fairly recent past. Those books really come out of this movement. Now, this movement that's happening here in America with pastoral care parallels another movement. And that's from our friend Friedrich Schleiermacher, who, among other things, served as a hospital chaplain in Berlin. And Schleiermacher made the assertion that the proper subject of theology is the believing Christian himself. And so theology does not have to do with God as he gives himself to us, clothed in the flesh of Christ, clothed in his words, but the focus of theology centers on the self. And this focus of theology then that was centered in the self was quite open to, and in fact demanded, a new approach to pastoral care, if you will. And here counseling really comes into the fore, and the liturgy is at best incidental, and perhaps even stands in the way of such effective pastoral caregiver. The pastor is seen to be a more authentic caregiver if he can dispense with the words of a text and simply make it up as he goes along. You see, it's more, becomes more real. The liturgy is seen then as something that is artificial or imposed, and what counts is the sincerity, the depth of piety, the passion of the pastoral care giver. Long about this time, there was the movement then to look at theological curriculum. If pastors are to be people pastors, people oriented, then perhaps there should be less emphasis on the study of dogma, church history, languages, exegesis, and more attention to the use of sociological or social sciences, especially psychology. And you see this in the so-called Emmanuel movement, named for Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Boston, 1905, where there was a movement to train ministers as practitioners, of psychology. This comes to a most notable point in 1925 with a man by the name of Anton Boisen, B-O-I-S-E-N, who was the founder of CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. Boisen himself was a Baptist minister, trained at Union. He had had a severe bout with mental illness himself, ended up in an institutionalized, and after he came out of that period of hospitalization, felt and believed that ministers ought to be trained in a clinical setting. And he organized this CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education, as a kind of an experimental program in 1925, and it became very popular in mainline and ultimately into evangelical denominations. Most noticeable about Boisen is that Boisen said that human beings are really the documents that the minister should exegete. Human beings are living documents, he said. And so the minister needs to know how to diagnose the psychological maladies and ailments there. Interestingly enough, the response, the main response to this whole movement came not from a theologian, but from a clinical psychologist by the name of Paul Preuser, who was at the Menninger Institute for many years. Preuser, and I think the book's listed on the bibliography there, wrote a little book called The Minister as Diagnostician. And the whole CPE movement, beginning with Boysen, had quite an emphasis on the pastor as making a diagnosis of the psychological difficulties that were there in a person, being able to recognize them and so forth. And Preusser was not theologically trained. He was a Christian, but his own training was in psychology. He made kind of the clarion call to the pastors to do what pastors do best, namely minister to people with word, with sacrament, with prayer. And he says that pastors have a particular set of tools that clinical psychologists do not possess according to their vocation, even though there may be, obviously, clinical psychologists who are believing Christians, as Preusser himself was. Preusser's comment, though, was that too many pastors were taking on the habitus of the counselor and forsaking that which is explicitly given to the pastor to do. And so you have a reaction to Boysen Paul Preusser. But nevertheless, this whole movement continued to go forward. Rollo May, The Art of Counseling, draws on Freud, Jung, Adler, and others. The next year after that, in 1940, May published another book, The Springs of Creative Living, which he dedicated to the theologian Paul Tillich. And there again, you can see the connection between this whole movement. And it's a movement in many ways in search of a theology. And the theology that it finally latches onto is the theology of Paul Tillich, with his especially with his method of correlation. Carl Rogers, again another counselor who started out as a Presbyterian seminarian, indebted to Tillich, made non-directive counseling popular in client-centered therapy. And this non-directive approach to counseling pretty much dominated courses in pastoral counseling in the 60s and 70s. It's the pastor never venturing to say, the scripture says, or thus saith the Lord, but rather, Joe, how do you feel about it? And the transactional analysis approach that comes a little later, which George Farrell commented about that. George Farrell, Luther scholar at University of Iowa, with a rather dry sense of humor sometimes, has this cartoon, Jesus hanging on the cross with somebody in dialogue with Jesus, and Jesus saying, if I'm okay and you're okay, what am I doing up here? That there's not much place for atonement, for forgiveness of sins in this, because it is all from finally human being to human being, and the pastor is certainly not there as a servant or representative of Christ, but is there simply to facilitate this kind of discussion. This is expressed, as I said, primarily in Stuart Hiltner's book, Preface to Pastoral Theology, Howard Klinbill, types of pastoral counseling. You also see it there. It's indebted to Paul Tillich. 3 points, especially that you see in Tillich, or actually 4 points. Tillich has a theological method, which he calls a method of correlation. This method of correlation for Tillich means that the biblical world is basically inaccessible to the modern mindset, and that to preach in biblical categories, to use words like sin and atonement and justification and grace, means that we will not be heard. And for Tillich, it is not simply a matter of catechesis. In other words, taking these biblical words and unpacking them. Tillich says you have to find another vocabulary. And the and the language that Tillich tries to use as receptor language for Christian theology is the language finally of psychology. And so what does grace become? Unconditional love or unconditional acceptance. God talk is out, and so God gets redefined as ground of being. And one of his most famous, in fact, it's the title of a collection of Tillich sermons, he redefines faith as ultimate concern. Now, if you take kind of Tillich's language and look at many of the pastoral theology books that were coming out in the 60s and beyond, you see it's most of those books are simply infiltrated with this kind of language. And then the question again for us here in this seminar is, what has happened to the church's primary language? That is the language of Scripture, the language of liturgy, the language of creed and catechism. That language has been left behind. What I am proposing here in this seminar is that the language of the liturgy is really the language of pastoral care, that we do not talk two different languages to our people. We do not use one language on Sunday morning in the divine service and then slip into the clinical mode when we make our visits or have our sessions, so-called counseling sessions or hospital visits. But there ought to be a congruity between the language of the church, which is the language of Scripture and the liturgy, and the language of pastoral care, because our people are being nourished in this language all along. It's the language, again, of forgiveness, of absolution, of life and salvation. And that the clinical language is just not stout enough to carry the load. It breaks. And then, of course, even worse, or as worse, as bad, would be trying to make the liturgy talk the language of the clinic. And there have been some liturgies that have been fashioned like that. I don't have it in my creative worship file. I lost it somewhere along the way, but I saw a liturgy that came out of the 60s again that was cast in the language of I'm okay, you're okay. Yeah. Bender likes that kind of thing, so. but that's the point that I wanted to make here with this kind of a very brief historical overview. What I'd like to do tomorrow is take maybe about 10-15 minutes and kind of fast forward this a bit through the so-called postmodern period that we find ourselves in now, and then step back and then go back to the way the church has historically understood this connectedness between liturgy and pastoral care, and then we'll start specifically looking at the rites of pastoral care as we have them in the agenda. We've got maybe just a couple minutes. That clock is about 3 minutes fast or 4 minutes fast. Any questions or observations at this point? Yeah.
As a vicar, even when somebody comes up to you, Ben, and asks concerning their dating. I mean, I was thinking of this kid here out there in Duluth, and I can't tell you how many times kids come up with me asking me questions about their love life. I mean,
does that say something about you, Preston, or?
To me, I felt really odd because I was reaching for my own experience my own experience as a young man. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't part of my vocation as a vicar, let alone committed. Say, hey,
you, Bender's got a grin on his face like he has something profound to say, so it's always there. Do you want to say something, Bender?
I thought
you wanted to.
I was at the same conference, I got another host.
You got, well, Peter. Well, I think you use you can use those opportunities again to catechize. The Ten Commandments do include something called the Sixth Commandment, or the first article of the Creed. And the, you know, what difference baptism makes. You don't make a very good Dear Abby. And pastors can be, you know, ought to be sued sometimes maybe for malpractice there when they try to imitate Dear Abby. But there's a way, I think, to use simply those kind of opportunities to speak to your people. And then I think the second thing, and Leah recognizes this also, that sometimes simply because nobody else is doing it, you know, think of how many times we as pastors have to do things because somebody else in the family simply isn't getting it done. That's in the realm of the extraordinary. And in that sense, it's an alien work, but a work that needs to be done so that the pastor might finally do his proper work.